The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
Okay, most people would introduce my next guest as an American financial analyst and commentator. You've seen him. He's been in Forbes magazine, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal. You've seen him on CNBC. I think I would prefer to just introduce him as a legend.
Yeah.
Because he really is a legend on Wall Street. This is a man who has been giving accurate predictions since 1969. And boy, that's a long time to be right. So we're pleased this morning to have with us Dr. Gary Schilling. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How about you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. And I want to know what you think about the markets. What's first of all, let's just kind of go around the trip here. What do you think of the markets and the weak start that we had last week for the year?
Well, there's obviously a tremendous amount of turmoil, much of it touched off by China. And China is going through a big transition, of course, from an economy led by exports and infrastructure spending. The exports went to North America and Europe, slow growth there. That's the end of that game. And globalization, the shifting of manufacturing to China, that's all over. There isn't much left to move. And, of course, all their infrastructure spending, they got all the ghost cities and excess capacity and huge debt levels. So China's wrestling with this. And part of this transition is this the financial problems they've had. And while China is a giant in manufacturing, it's an amateurish pygmy in financial markets. And we saw that last summer. The stocks declined 40%, very clumsy response for the government. They stopped trading. They forced, they basically skewered anybody who was negative on the market, wouldn't let anybody sell short, had state-owned enterprises underbuy stocks. And then even more recently, they've gone through this deal where they said, you know, as they say, we really want free markets, but they don't want free markets. They want to have control. They're control freaks. They still want top-down control. And they said, beginning of the year, they said that they wanted to allow markets to move, and that they weren't going to interfere as much. And they basically set a collar. They say we're not going to step in until stocks have declined 7%. Well, that was a too close collar. In 2 days in the first week of the year, it hit that collar, and so they threw that out. And they've done the same thing with their currency. They really want a cheaper currency to make their exports more attractive, imports less attractive, and they control the currency. But the markets really, in effect, tasted blood, and so they've had to intervene. Yesterday, they really dried up the alternative market for their currency, the yuan, in Hong Kong, pushed rates to 68% interday rates. In other words, they made it impossible for anyone to borrow and try to short the yuan. So you've got all this turmoil in China, which I think is probably the biggest driver of what's going on. But we're dealing with already, you know, fragile markets, very high prices for stocks here and abroad, very slow economic growth. It's not an environment where it can take a lot of shocks. And obviously, China coming along with this is very disruptive.
In fact, you said that in a comment that you made in an interview you did recently that China's economic glory days are over, like they're done, with the population at some point out there on China will turn negative. I think they'll actually have fewer folks on the planet than they do now. Is that true? I mean, like China's like. A lot of people thought it would become the powerhouse of the world. Apparently, you seem to think that it's not.
Yeah. Matter of fact, we just yesterday put out a special report, a supplement to our normal monthly Insight newsletter, spelling that out in detail. And if anybody would like to see that, let us know, email us. We'd be happy to send them a copy. But it really outlines this, and it is a situation where China was growing not because it was driven internally. China is not a self-growing economy. It is dependent on these exports. And again, if you don't have strong export markets because of slow growth in Europe and North America, and that's what I call the age of deleveraging, working off the excess debt buildup in the 80s and 90s. That's still going on, result of slow growth. We're so far in this expansion, we've had 2.2% average real GDP growth. That's about half what you'd expect after the most severe recession since the 30s. So you don't have that. So China has really not been able to grow independently. And again, when you had all this manufacturing shift from North America and Europe to China, it gave them a huge boost. That's what globalization was all about. You look at U.S. Manufacturing as a share of GDP in this country. You go back 20 years, it was 20%. It dropped to 12%, but it's leveled off. Just about everything that can move has moved. So you don't have this, makings of growth in China, and China is representative of developing countries in general. And again, China is really a underdeveloped country with a lot of people. I mean, their GDP per capita is only 14% of that of the U.S., even though they're the second largest economy in the world now. And it's just because they've got a 1.3 billion people. It isn't living standards. It isn't economic sophistication. It's a manufacturing machine, but it's really a still developing economy, which has to make this huge transition from being led by infrastructure and manufacturing to consumer spending and services, and that's tough.
Yeah, that is tough, and it's going to have a huge impact on the emerging markets, right? I mean, it's not a big deal to us, right, Gary? I mean, it's only, 4% of our economy or something like that with China? I mean, it's not a big deal to us, is it?
Yeah. Our exports to China, in other words, their demand for our goods and services is really pretty trivial. The effects are much more. We've been writing about this in our monthly newsletter over at least a year. We're saying the real effects of problems in China are not directly on the U.S. It's what it does to commodities. Because everybody thought China was going to buy all the commodities in the world, and for a while they were absorbing them. I mean, they were absorbing 45% of the world's production of tin, lead, zinc, immense amounts of iron ore, coal, stockpiling oil, and so on. Everybody thought that in effect China was growing independently, but they're just bringing this stuff in, processing, and then sending the manufactured goods out. So I think there was a big misconception on the role of China, and of course that backs up to all these huge expansions of commodity production. You know, front page of the Wall Street Journal today, Vale, this big Brazilian mineral producer,
right.
They're in trouble. They're scrambling to buy. They're drawing down bank loans because they can't get financing otherwise, and they're not alone. I mean, BHP, Billiton, you look at all these Glencore, you look at all these big mining companies in the middle of the last decade. They thought that this demand for commodities was going to just continue forever, so they got involved in these huge projects, things that take 5 to 10 years to come to fruition. Well, guess what? They came to fruition. The demand growth was very slow, huge excess supply, commodity prices are collapsing, and that's tough on these companies, but it's also tough on these countries, because a lot of these countries, they suffer from the curse of commodity richness. In other words, when oil was prices were high, countries like Angola and Nigeria, they didn't use those monies to develop their economy, to diversify. Where'd it go? It went into corruption. It went into high government salaries and so on. And now the oil prices declined. They're left high and dry. And the same is true of all these other commodities.
Right.
And look at Brazil. Look at Venezuela. I mean, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, they have had a huge impact on the commodity markets, which have done very poorly for a long, long time. By the way, folks, Insight, the newsletter is called Insight. You ought to go get a copy of it, and then you ought to subscribe. Go to www.agaryschilling.com, www.agaryschilling.com, and we'll be giving you the toll-free number when we come back. So stay with us. We've got Dr. Gary Schilling back to you in just a moment.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We have with us today Dr. Gary Schilling. Dr. Schilling is an analyst and a commentator. By the way, and I get his Insight newsletter, and I think it's just phenomenal. And I recommend that you do the same. And what did I do with it? Okay. There's an 800 number, 1-800-1888-346-7444. 888-346-7444. We'll put all this, by the way, on the Straight Talk Money website for you. That way, if you're driving, you don't have to veer off the road. And then the website is www.agaryschilling.com. agaryschilling.com. But as I say, for those of you that are driving, we'll put this on the website for you so you can tune into it and go and take a look. But Dr. Schilling, it's a phenomenal piece that he puts out every single month, and he's way ahead of the game. Most of the stuff you get there is most of the stuff that you can buy, I think, is a lot of fluff. Dr. Schilling's newsletter is not. He is way ahead of the game on what's going on out there. And Dr. Schilling, let me ask you. Let's kind of shift back. Well, I was going to ask you one more thing about overseas investing. Is it possible that India steps up? I'm trying to think of the only two places on the planet that have 1 billion people. Is it possible that India begins to step up and take some of the leadership that they thought that China would have?
Yes, absolutely. We've been very high on India. We started writing this up in our monthly insight, 3 years ago, I think it was. And I think India in the long run, and the title of the article was India Will Beat China in the Long Run. And there are a number of reasons for that. China is a top-down society. It's controlled by the party. They really don't brook dissent. They have no history of democracy. They have no history of free markets. In contrast, India is a democracy. And in contrast to China, which with this one child per couple policy, their labor force is shrinking. India does not have any limitations on birth. And India also inherited from the British a legal system, and of course the English language. They have large private companies. In China, the big companies are all state-owned enterprises, very inefficient, and a lot of corruption and political patronage involved in them. Now, India has a lot of corruption, and they do have the problem that they've had huge subsidies for rural areas. Rural poverty is still a major issue. But Modi, the current prime minister, he's been in there a couple of years, and he ran a state in India very, very efficiently, at least by Indian standards, much more a business model. And he's got a tough row to hoe. But I think in the long run, the advantages of India are there. And I look for India. Now, this is a long-term play. But if you're looking over the next 10 years or so, I'd bet on India. Because I think China, I mean, the title of this special report we put out was Chinese Sunset. You know, it's like Japan. Everybody got hot and bothered about Japan back in the 80s. Everybody thought they'd be working for a Japanese company to run out of business by them. Well, what happened? China's housing bubble broke at the end of the 80s. Their stock market broke, and they've had very slow growth, 1.1% average real GDP growth for 20 years, and deflation more years than not. And China has a lot of parallels with Japan. You know, one of the interesting examples of this, I keep a lot of files, clippings, and reports and so on. When I'm writing reports, I refer to them. And it used to be back in the 80s, I would have literally feet of files on Japan and maybe a couple inches in China. Now it's the reverse.
Right.
But I think China is going to go back to Japan size, and I'm now starting to build up my file on India.
All right. Well, let's take a look at the United States. What concerns you here in the U.S.? They're talking a lot about the junk bonds. They had a guy on the front with Goldman this morning that he thinks that the junk bond default rate can jump from a little over 1% to over 5% this year. There seems to be a lot of concern. I know in your latest issue of Insight, the January edition, you start off talking, you mentioned junk bonds and other benchmarks. What concerns you over here, and do junk bonds concern you?
Well, what happened with low interest rates, a lot of investors have simply not been willing to accept that, and that's individual investors. It's pension funds. A lot of pension funds still have built into their assumptions 8% returns on their investments. Well, this is just not an 8% return era. But they're committed to this. They've got their whole pensions geared to that, individual investors the same. And you know, by the way, at the end of the day, most of what people end up, individual investors, is what they save, not what they make in markets. But a lot of people hope that, you know, there's free lunch. I don't have to save. I can do it. The market will do it for me. But that's another story. The point is, because of this, you've had what I call zeal for yield. You've had this huge desire to move out on the risk curve in pursuit of high returns. And junk bonds has been one of the areas where that money has gone. And as a matter of fact, the default rate has been very low because it took real skill in recent years to default on junk bonds. There was so much money being thrown at these sub-investment grade companies that they really you had to work hard to default. Well, now that money has dried up. We had this fiasco with Third Avenue's, where it was a mutual fund, junk bonds. They basically refused to redeem it. Mutual funds are supposed to redeem every day. They said, no, we're closing it. And you've had this huge retreat from junk bonds. And of course, now with the new money, drying up, of course you're going to get defaults. Because a lot of these companies had just not been very careful about their investments. And again, when money was free, why do you need to be careful? You can make all kinds of inappropriate, investments.
Absolutely. What do you think of the stock market? What are you looking for this year? Positive, well, negative, single digit?
Yeah, I would say the stock market, from the beginning of the bear market, which was March of 2009, through 2014, it was driven by Federal Reserve money. The Fed embarked first on bailing out Wall Street and then on what they call quantitative easing, buying huge quantities of securities. And they bought it. Let's say they bought a treasury bond from you or me. What did most people do with it? They put it into stocks. So you had this money moving from the Fed into stocks. And that was, as far as I'm concerned, what supported the market. It wasn't earnings growth. It wasn't the economy. It was this largesse from the Fed. But that ended. The Fed ended that quantitative easing program at the end of 2014. And so you really don't have that fundamental support for stocks. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to collapse, but it does mean that the upward push, the upward momentum, the fuel under the fire is no longer being added. And at the same time, stocks are very expensive. If you look at stocks in relation to earnings on a long-term basis, they're about 40% overvalued. And if you look at earnings per se, I mean, earnings have not been solidly based in this expansion on revenue growth, because with very slow real economic growth, you haven't had the unit volume growth, and of course you've got no inflation, so there's no pricing power. You can't raise prices, so business has gotten to profits by cutting costs. Now most of those costs are labor costs, and that's why real wages, in other words, adjusted for inflation, have been flat throughout this expansion. But the point is that this is that profits were driven by cost cutting. Well, that has ended in the last couple of years. That huge leap in profit margins is over. Now, whether that means they're scraped the bottom of the barrel or they picked all the low-hanging fruit, they have to wait for more to ripen remains to be seen. But you no longer have that push. So profits are going up from here is unlikely.
I'm coming on to a hard break. Hang on just a second. I'll let you finish your thought on the other side of the break.
The following is a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.
We're speaking today with Dr. Gary Schilling, who I think is one of the legends on Wall Street. Dr. Schilling, before we get to your final comments, tell the folks about the Insight newsletter, how to reach you, a little commercial time.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate that. unabashed publicity. Yeah, if someone would like a sample copy of our monthly newsletter, just let us know. You can email us at www.agaryschilling.com, or we have a toll-free number, 1-888-346-7444. And I mentioned at the outset of this program that we just put out a special release on China. Normally it's a monthly newsletter, but we thought that China was particularly interesting right now considering the gyration so far this year, so we put out a special report, and if anyone would like to see that, we'd be happy to send it on.
Okay, great. All right. Now, let me just a few final questions. So you're not looking for a huge move in the market. Most of the people, I think, are single digit. I need to ask you what you think about interest rates. I'm getting quite a difference of opinion from some of my guests. I have one that's saying, I've had one that said, nope, one and done, we're finished. And more likely she's going to have to reduce rates. I have others that are saying no, where there are going to be multiple rate increases next year. Where do you stand?
Well, and let me say on stocks, I don't think stocks are going anywhere on the upside to speak of, and the risk is on the downside, as I talked either. In terms of interest rates, yeah, the Fed painted themselves into a corner. They cried wolf. They talked about a strong economy, raising rates so often that if they hadn't done it in December, their credibility would have been even further impaired. I think they very well may end up reducing rates. About half a dozen central banks since the recession raised rates and then had to reduce them, and the Fed may do the same, because their twin goals are price stability, and they interpret that as 2% inflation, and we got deflation and full employment, and we certainly don't have that. You got a lot of people unemployed. If it hadn't had all the dropouts from the labor force, the unemployment rate wouldn't be 5%, it'd be 13%. So I think the Fed may back away. Now, that in itself isn't all that important when you're talking about Treasury bonds, which is my long-term favorite. I've been, as you know, I've been a bull on Treasury since 1981, when the yield on the 30-year bond was 15.2%. Now it's under 3%. They've outperformed stocks since the early 80s by six times. So that's where my concentration is. And the spillover from what the Fed does to what happens to 10-year Treasury notes and 30-year Treasury bonds is surprisingly little. If you have a 1 percentage point increase, and this is on average in the post-World War II period, 1 percentage point increase in the Fed funds rate, which is what the Fed controls, you get only 0.35% increase in yields on 10 years and 0.25% increase in 30 years. So it is surprising. And one of the interesting things, last Friday, you remember, a very strong job report. You would expect that stocks would go up and treasuries would sell off. In other words, interest rates would go up. What happened? Quite the opposite. And it tells you there's an awful lot of other things going on out there. And so we're looking for a decline in yields on 30-year treasuries are now a little less than 3%. We're looking at that to decline to 2%, maybe in a year, maybe longer, and for 10-year treasuries to drop to 1% yield. And that's really because they're the safe haven. You got deflation. You got everybody. And treasuries actually have higher yields than most of their equivalents in other countries. So foreign investors can come here, invest in treasuries, and with the strengthening dollar, they make money when they translate the gains back to their own currencies.
Wow. Well, sounds like a good place to be. Sounds like better than stocks, because there's not much opportunity in stocks. What do you think of gold? They've had a little rally lately. But
I'm agnostic on gold. I don't understand it, but I'd say it seems to be acting more like just one more commodity than is anything special recently.
Yeah, I agree. And commodities, boy, they've been rough. I saw a report that commodities have been down an average of 5.1% over the last 10 years.
And as a matter of fact, if you look at commodities, and we have data going back to 1749, I'm not sure about 1748, but from 1749 on, if you look at commodities adjusted for inflation, they have declined consistently. You get spikes in wars, or like the oil embargoes in the 1970s, but commodities long-term decline. What it says is human ingenuity beats shortages any time. All the arguments, there's only so much copper and iron ore in the Earth's crust and so on. Okay, fine. I can remember when serious economists, grown men and women, predicted that telecommunications was going to come to a grinding halt because there wasn't enough copper to make the wires you needed to transmit data. Well, what happened? Fiber optics. I mean, forget copper wires. So human ingenuity always has beat shortages. And so commodities, in a long-term sense, we've done very well in them, and our portfolio is short in recent years. But commodities on the long side, except for very brief periods, they are not a very good investment. They are losers, as a matter of fact.
I would agree. I used to be a commodity broker about 40 years ago. Dr. Schilling, thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your insight. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Hope you'll come back. Thank you, sir.
I sure will.
By the way,
to.
Folks, it's called the Insight Newsletter, www.agaryschilling.com. And the phone number is 888-346-7444, 888-346-7444.
You have been listening to a rebroadcast of Straight Talk About Money. The market data in this rebroadcast is not current and should not be used for any financial decisions.